Hello, this is the Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service with reports and analysis from across the world. The latest news 7 days a week. BBC World Service podcasts are supported by advertising.
Les plateformes de formation en réalité virtuelle, comme ForgeFX, permettent aux élèves en soudure de développer les compétences nécessaires pour débuter et faire évoluer leur carrière. Meta et le métavers ont déjà un impact.
Cataracts are the world's leading cause of avoidable blindness. The metaverse can help address that problem. A virtual reality platform created by Fundamental VR and Orbis International helps train doctors to treat cataracts, resulting in more confident surgeons operating all over the world. With virtual reality training, surgeons can practice over and over to gain skills. Meta and the metaverse are having impact today.
This is the Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service. I'm Alex Ritson, and in the early hours of Monday, the 25th of March, these are our main stories. Russia charges two suspects over the deaths of at least 137 people in the attack on a Moscow concert hall.
It was a big shot because I live nearby and I saw it from my windows. It's horrific.
Ukraine says it struck two Russian ships and the major communications post for Russia's Black Sea Fleet in occupied Crimea. And the supreme leader of the Afghan Taliban defends stoning and public whipping of women. Also in this podcast, more than 130 school children abducted earlier this month in Kaduna State in Nigeria have been freed. And
here's a group of animals. We've had their photographs in our shoeboxes for all these years, trying to figure out who they are. And they've been our mystery animals. Realize there is a pattern here.
The remarkable discovery of what's thought to be a new population of killer whales in our seas. Four men, the Russian authorities claim, are suspects in the attack on the concert hall on Friday, have appeared in court in Moscow. State media said two of them had been charged with committing an act of terrorism and that one of them, from Tajikistan, had pleaded guilty. 137 people were killed in the massacre at Crocus City Hall. Flags were lowered across Russia on Sunday as Muscovites donated blood for the wounded. Our Russia editor Steve Rosenberg reports from Moscow.
This was a country in mourning. And in shock, across Russia, flags flew at half-mast for the victims of the concert hall massacre. And at the scene of Friday's attack, Crocus City Hall, the queues grew longer and longer. The National Day of Mourning experienced most acutely here. There was an outpouring of sympathy, a mountain of tributes to the dead.
As well as leaving flowers and candles, people have also been bringing soft toys and sweets, because amongst the dead, there were children. They've also been leaving messages. One is addressed to the attackers, and it reads, "You are scum. We will never forgive you."
Among the crowd, there was a mixture of grief and anger.
It was a big shot because I live nearby, and I saw it from my windows. It's horrific and a big tragedy.
Such a terrible loss, says Natalia. I'll never forgive or forget. Bring back the death penalty, Yevgeny says, for terrorists, for sure. This is how the attack had begun. With gunmen in the foyer and desperate attempts to take cover. The attackers moved on to the auditorium. By the end of this, more than 130 people were dead. Tonight, the suspected gunman appeared in court. Russia claims they'd been caught trying to flee to Ukraine and had contacts there. Kyiv fiercely denies any link to the attack. The Islamic State group says it was behind the shooting. And on this day of mourning, silent prayers from a somber-looking President Putin. The Kremlin says he lit a candle for the victims in church at his country estate. And Russia is praying that there will be no more attacks. If there are, that will test people's faith in the president to keep them safe.
Steve Rosenberg reporting from Moscow. Meanwhile, Ukraine's armed forces say they've hit two Russian landing ships and a communication centre in occupied Crimea. Early on Sunday, Russia targeted a number of regions across Ukraine with missiles and drones. From Kyiv, here's Sarah Rainsford.
There were powerful explosions in occupied Crimea overnight as Ukraine fired dozens of missiles at the peninsula. The military here says two Russian landing ships were destroyed, as well as a naval communications centre. That would be a significant blow, though we've seen no images yet to confirm the claim. Russian officials do say it was the biggest attack on the port city of Sevastopol in recent times. It happened as Russia fired dozens more of its missiles and drones across Ukraine. That meant sirens, bomb shelters and explosions for the third night in a row. In Lviv in the west, officials say critical infrastructure was hit. And as Russia targeted the city, one missile crossed the Polish border. It was flying over NATO territory for 39 seconds. The missile was tracked by Polish radars, we're told, and would have been shot down had it been heading for a target in Poland. In Warsaw, the foreign ministry said it was demanding an explanation. But most of all, it was calling on Moscow to stop what it called Russia's terrorist air attacks on Ukraine.
Sarah Rainsford in Kyiv. When the Taliban in Afghanistan seized power again nearly 3 years ago, they said women had nothing to fear and their rights would be protected. But the opposite has happened. Girls can't go to secondary school or university, and women are banned from many places of work and have to abide by strict dress codes. Now, in a rare audio message, the supreme leader of the Afghan Taliban has defended the practice of stoning women and public lashing. I heard more from our South Asia regional editor, Anbarasan Etirajan.
He has come out with this audio message where he's talking about they will implement the Sharia law at whatever cost. Even though people may criticize, it may be against the principles of Western democracy or women's rights, we will continue to carry out the public executions and stoning, especially for moral offenses, and public floggings will be continued under the Taliban regime. He talked about the struggle. They fought for 20 years and it is not the end. And we are ready to, you know, continue with our quest to implement this Islamic law across the country and even beyond.
A lot of people will see these kinds of punishments as barbaric. Why are these important to him?
Because the Taliban always talked about Islamic Emirate. They want to have an Islamic state where all the Islamic rules are followed, and they have always been insisting that if we are following Islamic rule, then we implement Sharia law improper.
It is rare for him to speak. Why now?
We don't know exactly why this particular audio was released, but during this new year of Navroz, when the new academic year starts and many people are complaining, you know, for the third year now, girls are not going to the secondary schools. At the same time, they've been banned from going to the universities. So there were a lot of comments on social media. You know, another year is coming. Taliban should relax their policies about education of women. So that is probably one of the reasons why they're coming out with this statement.
Because he obviously knows how this is going to be seen in the West.
It's a defiant message because even though the UN and other Western powers have been telling the Taliban, if you need international recognition, then you have to adhere to certain rights, like respecting human rights, respecting women's rights. But at the end of the day, you know, if you look at the population of Afghanistan, people are suffering. It's extreme poverty, unemployment. You don't have any industries. Previously, it was all coming from international funding, particularly from the US. In addition to that, more Afghans who have been sent back from Pakistan and Iran, they are coming back to the country. So the country is in a very, very difficult situation.
Anbarasan Etirajan. The Nigerian army says more than 130 schoolchildren abducted earlier this month in Kaduna State have been freed. A military spokesman says they were rescued in the early hours of Sunday morning, but it's not clear if a ransom was paid. Our correspondent in Johannesburg, Jenny Hill, sent this report.
The children look exhausted, their uniforms filthy, in photos released by the Nigerian authorities. It's more than 2 weeks since the students, aged between 8 and 15, were kidnapped from their school. Teachers reported that gunmen on motorbikes seized more than 280 children. Officials who claim that all of the children are now free have not yet commented on the discrepancy. In previous mass kidnappings, some victims have managed to escape from their captors, and there can be initial confusion about the number of victims. It's also unclear how the children were freed. The kidnappers had demanded a ransom of nearly $700,000. The governor of Kaduna State, Uba Sani, said their release was due to the courage of the Nigerian security forces. He also thanked the Nigerian president for his help. This was, he added, a day of joy.
Jenny Hill. Scientists in Canada are believed to have discovered a new population of orcas. The massive mammals, also popularly known as the killer whale, are the ocean's top predator. Researchers at the University of British Columbia in Vancouver say a group of 49 mystery whales off the west coast of California do not match any other known types of orcas. Their research draws on 25 years of whale sightings. Andrew Trites is a professor and director of the Marine Mammal Research Unit at the University of British Columbia. He told Julian Warwicker more about what made these whales so unique.
From a photograph of a killer whale, it's like a fingerprint. Each dorsal fin has a unique shape. Sometimes they have nicks and scars on them. And behind, on top of the killer whale, they have what we call a saddle patch, a sort of a grayish area. That has a unique shape as well. And so it's possible then to know each killer whale individually just from a single photograph. Over the years, it's been possible to put together essentially family albums or family trees where we can relate individuals to each other as well as to those that they've associated with. On the west coast of North America, we have three ecotypes of killer whales. One that specializes in eating only marine mammals, one that specializes in eating only fish, and another one that specializes in eating sharks and large fish. And so we have these populations. They've now been fairly well studied. We've got 49 animals, and their pictures don't match with any of the other known individuals.
And what do these 49 eat?
We've seen them eating marine mammals, so that tells us that they're related to the marine mammal ecotype. But we've also seen them eating a sea turtle, which is a little bit different. But I think one of the other things that really stood out to us with this group compared to all the others is that on their bodies, they're missing chunks of flesh. They're small chunks, but these are caused by cookie cutter sharks. They're not there to kill the whale, but simply to get a free meal. And of these animals, 46 of the 49 had cookie cutter shark marks. And these bite marks are coming from a species that lives in more tropical waters. So it tells us that while we've seen this population north, it's likely spending a lot of time in more tropical waters as well.
Is it also right that they have preyed on sperm whales on some occasions?
Yes, that is one of the species that was seen being attacked. And the sperm whales are quite interesting. In this case, it was a group of 12 killer whales attacking 9 adult female sperm whales. And the sperm whales, when they're under attack, they form a rosetta whereby they put their heads in the center and their tails out to lash out at what's attacking them, in this case, the killer whales. And the killer whales will just be relentless and ultimately did kill one of the individuals.
But sperm whales are enormous.
They are enormous. And that's one of the things about this group is they're feeding in the open ocean and they're feeding in a location so far from shore. And in order to corner the prey out there, they can't rely on pushing it to the bottom or into the near shore. They have to work together to both corner the animal, prevent it from diving deeper. And a sperm whale can, of course, dive much deeper than what a killer whale can. But working together, they're able to make a living there and capture and take down very large animals such as sperm whales. We do our best to observe what's going on. And every now and then we see something that doesn't quite fit. And here's a group of animals. We've had their photographs in our shoeboxes for all these years, trying to figure out who they are. And they've been our mystery animals to realize there is a pattern here. And after 25 years, we think this is a new population unknown to science. And we believe they should be referred to as the oceanic population of killer whales.
So you know about 49, but presumably there may be more. There may be many more.
You're exactly right. And the process of discovering new animals, we can start to plot up the new ones we've seen as well as the repeat sightings. And we call that a discovery curve. We're still on the very steep portion. It's rising. We don't know where it's going to top out at. It's at 100, 200, maybe 300. What is interesting is that while this paper has just come out, it's actually getting people to look through some of their photographs. And it does appear, in fact, that there are some other unknown individuals that likely do belong to this population.
Andrew Trites speaking to Julian Warwicker. Still to come in the Global News Podcast. Celebrating 60 years of music with the Colombian legend Fruco. Counting is underway in Senegal following the controversial delayed presidential election. The vote in the West African state took place after weeks of political unrest following the outgoing president Macky Sall's attempt to delay the election. The constitution barred him from running for a third term, but he endorsed the former Prime Minister Amadou Ba, who said the day had passed peacefully.
The message we're sending out is one of peace. Senegal belongs to us. We're all children of this country. We competed, the electoral campaign went well, even if it was short, but it was calm. There was no violence.
In what many see as a crucial test for a country that was until recently seen as a beacon of democracy in the region, Mr. Sall said that no one should claim victory before the results are announced. And another leading candidate, Bassirou Diomi Faye, urged people to accept the outcome whoever wins. My colleague James Copnell told me more about how the day went.
I've been around several polling stations in the capital, Dakar. In every case, people were voting. There were no logistical problems. I did meet one woman who said she couldn't find her name on the list, that there had been a problem. And there's some indications that that happened too in another place on the outskirts of Dakar. But broadly speaking, and confirming this too with a couple of observers I've spoken to in different places, including the head of the regional body, ECOWAS's observation mission, they say that it has been a peaceful, calm and largely orderly vote.
And this comes after weeks of unrest following President Sall's attempt to delay the election.
Yeah, truly an astonishing moment in Senegal's history. A president who had, it seemed to many, flirted with the idea of an unconstitutional third term, then suddenly in February announced that, oh, these polls in a couple of weeks, we're not going to have them. I want to push them back to December. There was such an outcry at that, domestic and international pressure. A constitutional court ruling ultimately saying, no, you can't delay for that period of time. But that led many to question to what extent Senegal truly was this bastion of democracy. But look, the polls have taken place, the vote a month or so late, but they have taken place before the end of President Macky Sall's mandate. We're at the counting phase now. We'll wait to see how people react to the results. But you can certainly make the case that democracy seems back on track.
So, 19 candidates. Who were the most prominent?
I think without a doubt, Bassirou Diomi Faye, who you've already mentioned, an opposition leader. He's the protege, really, of Ousmane Sonko, even more popular opposition figure, who isn't allowed to run because of a court judgment against him that he and his supporters see as politically motivated. But Bassirou Diomi Faye, Sonko's candidate, is seen as the voice of change, if you like. And the main figure against him is Amadou Ba, who we heard a clip of earlier, the former prime minister. He's the establishment candidate. Plenty of other candidates too, people close perhaps to those in power, several opposition figures too. The question, I suppose, is will anyone be able to get a majority in the first round, or as perhaps seems more likely, are we heading for a second round given the number of candidates?
So when do we get the results?
We're expecting it sometime in the next 2-3 days. Has to be by the end of the week. I suspect it'll be before that. In the next few hours, we might have some indication of the direction it's going, but I wouldn't expect results straight away.
James Copnell. Israeli forces have been continuing their ground and air attacks in many parts of Gaza despite persistent calls for a ceasefire. They've been targeting in particular the Shifa hospital, where they say Hamas fighters are hiding. Meanwhile, the Palestinian population is suffering from hunger and malnutrition. The head of the UN's aid agency, UNRWA, says Israel is preventing its food convoys from entering the north of Gaza. Speaking in Egypt, the UN Secretary General, Antonio Guterres, said a humanitarian ceasefire was imperative.
The current horrors in Gaza serve no one, and they're having an impact around the globe. The daily assault on the human dignity of Palestinians is creating a crisis of credibility for the international community. It is challenging the values we proclaim as universal. It is challenging international law. It is challenging core humanitarian principles. It is challenging our basic humanity.
Our Middle East correspondent Yolande Nel is following developments from Jerusalem.
The Israeli military says that it's hit 65 targets in the Gaza Strip in the past 24 hours. Still, the main focus of its operations there remains the Shifa Hospital in Gaza City. Its troops returned there for a major raid last Monday. And we're hearing from the Israeli military that now something like 800 people have been arrested in that area. And it says that something like 480 members of Hamas and Islamic Jihad are among those who've been arrested. Also, 170 people it's calling terrorists have been killed. It's very difficult to contact Palestinians in that area. Communications are poor, but Palestinians there, including displaced people, medics and patients, well, we've been hearing from some of them that conditions are desperate. It's very hard for them to get access to any medicine and food, and the innocent people are among those who've been killed. Five patients are said to have died. Meanwhile, Palestinian medics are saying that there is also fighting very close to two hospitals in the south of the Gaza Strip, and it's still not clear exactly what happened a day ago when Hamas officials in Gaza say that Israeli forces killed 19 people and wounded 20 more as they were waiting for an aid convoy to arrive in Gaza City. The Israeli military has denied that its forces opened fire and say that they're still investigating exactly what happened there. Meanwhile, those talks still going on in Qatar, indirect talks between Israel and Hamas on a new ceasefire and hostage release deal. But we've got the members of the US delegation, the CIA director, and also the head of the Israeli delegation, the head of the Mossad spy agency, leaving the talks for the moment. A Palestinian official close to them telling journalists that big gaps remain between the two sides.
Yoland Nell. The Philippines is one of the countries in the world most at risk from the effects of climate change, with typhoons and droughts becoming more common and more severe. At the same time, it has some of the most expensive energy in Southeast Asia. BBC What in the World's Hannah Gilbert has been to Manila to find out if solar power could be the answer to the Philippines' energy problems.
I'm on the top story of a car park in the middle of Manila. The mall below me is blasting out air conditioning. But up here in the sun, it is the middle of the day and it's baking hot. And above me are row upon row of solar panels. They are helping to generate energy that goes back into the grid to help power buildings like the mall below. Now, solar is one type of renewable energy that lots of countries are embracing as they try to reduce the effects of climate change. It's particularly appealing here as the Philippines relies heavily on imported coal and it has some of the most expensive energy in all of Southeast Asia. Talking to people out and about in Manila, we heard how worried they are about the climate and energy. If I say climate change, what is the first thing you think of?
More difficulty in sustaining life.
We know exactly what will happen to all of us if we cannot reverse that climate change.
It's a tropical country, so I do believe that having too much sun or having too much heat can really affect people.
Although too much sun can be harmful, solar energy is a valuable resource and it's one of the main alternatives to fossil fuels. I spoke to Gisette Enano, a local journalist, and Joshua Miguel Lopez, an energy engineer, about why electricity costs so much.
I think the primary reasons why it's so expensive, it's because of the transmission costs. The way that the systems are set up in the Philippines is that the way we get our power is so centralized. And coal in the Philippines, most of it is imported from other countries. And so we are heavily reliant on the world market.
Is there already some renewable energy in the market? How much energy is being generated by solar or other forms of other sources?
So as of 2022, the renewable energy is already 32.2% of the electricity generation in the Philippines. Most of it comes from geothermal and hydro because we have a lot of volcanoes in the Philippines. Solar and wind, even though there were projects since the Renewable Energy Act was passed, there's still little development for solar and wind.
I think it's not a matter of choosing this renewable energy over that. It's a matter of actually looking at all the resources that is available to us and diversifying.
One of the main critiques about renewable energy is that it's intermittent. But if you diversify it, the fluctuations would eventually balance out. Based on the potential of rooftop solar in one of the recent studies by Climate Analytics, rooftop solar alone could already supply the electricity needs back in 2022.
But a transition to renewable energy has to be done in the right way. This is Mitzi Janelle Tan, a local climate activist.
Something that's already happening today, where a lot of solar farms are displacing farmers who do not own their own land. A lot of hydro dams are displacing indigenous communities and causing floods to nearby communities. And you have these projects that aren't actually consulted with the communities, consulted with experts on how to address the energy issue. And that's the thing. I think our energy people are still considering the energy crisis separate from the climate and biodiversity crisis, not realizing that we need to tackle all of them together, because if we have the renewable energy but it destroys biodiversity in the process, that makes us more vulnerable to climate impacts, which makes electricity more difficult for us to have, and it just becomes a loop. So we really need to have a holistic approach when approaching this.
I'm back here on the roof of the car park in the shade of some of these huge solar panels above me. And it was so interesting to hear about how solar could be part of a much needed move towards renewable energy. Feeling the heat here, it is easy to imagine why.
Anna Gelbert. And if you want to hear the full episode, search for BBC What in the World wherever you get your BBC podcasts. Conservationists say they've rescued 18 orphaned bear cubs in Laos in the past week. 16 were found inside a private home after a tip-off from a neighbour. The other two were confiscated from a farm. Asiatic black bears are trafficked but kept as pets in the region or farmed to produce an ingredient in traditional medicine. Our Asia-Pacific editor Celia Hatton reports.
On social media, the orphaned bears are shown clambering out of travel crates as animal workers wait with bottles of milk nearby. 16 cubs were found inside a house in the capital, Vientiane, several days ago, marking the biggest ever rescue in Laos. Rescuers say it's possible the bears' mothers were trafficked or perhaps killed in efforts to extract bile from their gallbladders for use in traditional medicine. Wildlife officials have been trying to end the trade in the bile of Asiatic black bears, also known as moon bears. Bile farming is painful and often fatal for bears.
Celia Hatton. Fruco is one of Colombia and Latin America's biggest music stars. This year he's marking six decades of playing everything from salsa to psychedelia and Latin jazz. A native of the city of Medellin, Fruco has used his music to try to bring joy to a country that's experienced decades of violent conflict. Ahead of his performance at London's Latin music festival La Linea next month, Martin Venard asked Fruco about his start in professional music at the tender age of 13.
Logré, gracias a Dios, ingresar a la orquesta.
Thanks to God, I managed to join what at the time was Colombia's most famous group, Los Corraleros de Majagual. They played music from the north coast of Colombia. It's very joyful music, which produced some very big hits. At that time, I played the timbal, which is a kind of drum, so I was the drummer, the timbal player in Los Corraleros de Majagual.
El Corralero del Majagual.
You've recorded some famous salsa songs such as El Preso, The Prisoner. Tell us about that.
Esta canción fue
That song was composed by Álvaro Velázquez. In 1975, it was recorded by my group, Fruco y Sus Tesos. It is a prayer to God by the prisoner to get him out of prison. The song was based on a letter written by a prisoner in Toronto, Canada, who was doing 30 years for drug trafficking. It was sent to the composer, who decided to write the words, and it was up to me to sing them, which was a very beautiful and unforgettable experience.
Fue muy bonita e inolvidable.
You're from Medellin, where the drugs cartel leader Pablo Escobar was from. What legacy has he left in your city?
Bueno, te quiero contar, Martín.
I want to tell you that my path in life has been very different to his, and he was not someone I knew. But in the city of Medellin, there are sometimes tours that come to see where his story started. But we don't want to promote crimes that cause sadness, pain and poverty for some, but riches for others.
Y riqueza para otros.
stood for the Senate for the party of the then president, Juan Manuel Santos. What did you hope to achieve?
Firstly, I wanted to highlight the work of musicians, because our country has a system which is not well set up to allow artists to emerge and to pay them their royalties. And so my plan was not only to represent musicians and obtain guarantees for them, but also to open doors in the Senate to things such as tourism with music, so that tourists could feel happy to come and enjoy our music, which is among the most joyful in the world.
De los más alegres del mundo.
Colombia has suffered from decades of conflict with armed groups and drug cartels and kidnappings. Can a musician help bring people together?
Yes, that is our job, because our country has lots of problems due to political polarization. But we are dedicated to living happily in a country that has lots of beautiful places and a wonderful climate. So I feel very happy to be able to do that. I am 73 years old. This year, I'm marking 60 years in music, and I feel very happy about it.
Y entonces me siento muy alegre.
The Colombian legend Fruco speaking to Martin Venard. And that's all from us for now, but there'll be a new edition of the Global News podcast later. If you want to comment on this podcast or the topics covered in it, you can send us an email. The address is globalpodcast@bbc.co.uk. You can also find us on X at Global News Pod. This edition was mixed by Craig Kingham, and the producer was Emma Joseph. The editor is Karen Martin. I'm Alex Ritson. Until next time. Goodbye.
It's a high-stakes election year, so it's not enough to just follow along. You need to understand what's happening so you are fully informed come November. Every weekday on the NPR Politics Podcast, our political reporters break down important stories and backstories from the campaign trail so you understand why it matters to you. Listen to the NPR Politics Podcast wherever you get your podcasts.